And so kind of the simplest model that exhibits a quantum phase transition is this transverse field Ising model. So, you know, this is the transverse field Ising model is the same to quantum phase transitions as the classical Ising model to classical phase transitions. It's just the simplest, provides the simplest realization of a quantum phase transition. Sigma jz minus h sum over I sigma I x. And so I drew this phase diagram last time, so we can have the vertical axis is the ratio of h over j, the transverse field, to the interaction between the spins, and the horizontal axis is the ratio of t over j. Okay, and so when we talked about classical phase transitions, we were working along this axis. Right, so there is a transition somewhere here at TC, right? And then, so in general, we have something like this. Okay, so this is the critical ratio of H over J, where transition at zero temperature happens along this axis. So everywhere here, I have a ferromagnetic phase, which means that the expectation value of sigma z is not zero, right? While everywhere here I have a disordered or paramagnetic phase where this expectation value is equal to zero, okay? And so now we will be interested on in what happens in along this axis. So at zero temperature, but there's a function of this ratio of H over J, okay? And so as we will see today, it's possible to kind of generalize what we've been talking about for classical phase transitions to this case. Okay, so let's see how this works. So it turns out to be convenient for this actually to assume in all the intermediate steps that the temperature is finite, okay, and then take the temperature to zero at the end. Okay, so let me assume that T is finite, but so later we will take the limit of temperature going to zero. Okay, so then I can still think of evaluating the partition function in the same way we did before. And so the partition function is the trace of e to minus h over t, or so a common notation that's used is that, so this 1 over t is renamed to beta, trace e to minus beta h, okay? So beta is 1 over t, okay? And so in what follows, I will use the units where h bar is equal to 1, okay? So then, okay, so 1 over t is inverse energy, right? But so in units where in which h bar is equal to 1, inverse energy is time, okay? So this beta has units of time. Okay. Okay, so I have to, in principle, evaluate this trace of beta j sum over I and j sigma I z sigma j z and then plus beta h sum over I sigma I x. But so this problem of evaluating this trace is even more difficult, of course, than the problem of evaluating this trace in the classical Ising model, right? And the complication here, again, is that in this case, those two terms in the Hamiltonian do not commute, right? What it means is that it's impossible to find a basis which diagonalizes both of those terms, right? So so if you could find such a basis, then the problem would again be the same as the one for the classicalizing model, right? It's just a sum over eigenvalues of whatever whatever the basis choice is, right? But it's impossible, and that's precisely why we have a quantum phase transition. Okay, so I'm going to deal with that problem of the non-commutativity of those two terms by the following formal trick. So at this stage, it's going to be a formal trick, but then very quickly we will see that it has a important physical meaning. Okay. So the trick is called a Trotter decomposition. Okay. So let me do the following. Let me pick an integer number I will call capital M. Okay. And let this be a large number. I will later send it to infinity. So large integer, okay, and so let me divide now this time beta into m small intervals, okay. So let epsilon, which also has dimensions of time, be beta divided by m, okay, and I will assume that m is such that that epsilon is small, okay? So epsilon is small. So what does it mean that it's small? Well, it has to be at least small compared to all the intrinsic time scales in the problem, right? And the intrinsic time scales in the problem are, you know, 1 over j and 1 over h. Since j and h are the intrinsic energy scales in the problem, inverse of that would be the intrinsic time scales. So epsilon must be much smaller than either 1 over j or 1 over h. Okay. Okay, so let me erase this thing. Okay, and so then what I want to do is I want to write this e to minus beta h as a product of m pieces, okay? So I'm going to write z, so this is trace of e to minus beta h. But I can also write this as trace e to minus epsilon h times e to minus epsilon h, and so on, m times, right? So there are m factors here. Okay. And so now, so let me really take the limit of epsilon going to zero, right? Which means that I take m to infinity, but in such a way that epsilon times m is finite and equal to beta, right? So then, in the limit when epsilon is very small, right, I can Taylor expand this this exponential here. So so in the limit when epsilon is small, e to minus epsilon h is approximately equal to 1 minus epsilon h plus terms of order epsilon square, which I will ignore. Okay. Okay. So now, okay. So let me explicitly decompose this Hamiltonian now into the sum of two non-commuting terms. So I'll say that h is equal to h0 plus h1, where h0 is minus j sum on I and j sigma I sigma j, and so h1 is going to be minus the transverse field, sum over I sigma I x, right? Okay, so then I get this is equal to 1 minus epsilon h0 minus epsilon h1, right? And then what I can do is re-exponentiate those terms back, right? But neglecting the fact that they don't commute, because the corrections from their non-commutativity will be of order epsilon squared. Okay, so this is the same, right? So they obviously in this expansion to linear order and epsilon, it doesn't matter whether H0 comes first and then H1 comes next or vice versa, since the addition is obviously a commutative operation. But the non-trivial thing is that then I can re-exponentiate them, and I can, so let me put H1 to the left of H0. So this is minus E to minus epsilon times H1 times E to minus epsilon times H0, okay? Yeah. No, so H is the sum of H0 and H1. So if I expand those exponentials to linear order and epsilon, I get 1 minus.
All right, yeah. Okay. So using the reverse Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula?
Sorry?
Using the reverse of the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula here for the exponential of some operators?
Yeah, so I'm just using this Taylor expansion backwards, right?
Because the next thing would be order of epsilon squared times the commutator.
Right, right. So you know, in general, right, so the point is that if H consists of two non-commuting terms, right, then in general this is not true. So let's say E to minus beta H is not equal to E to minus beta H1 times E to minus beta H0, okay? There is a commutator that has to come in there, okay? So this is certainly not true. But this is true to order epsilon, okay? So this is called, this kind of ordering is called, in this context, normal ordering, okay? So H1, where H1 is to the left of H0, this is normal ordering. Okay, so then I have my Z is equal to trace, and so I have E to minus epsilon H1, E to minus epsilon H0, times again E to minus epsilon H1, E to minus epsilon H0, and so on, E to minus epsilon H1, E to minus epsilon H0, okay? And now let me do the following. Let me, so between each pair of factors like this, let me insert what's called an identity resolution, right? So you know that if I take any complete set of states in quantum mechanics, I can write identity operator in the following way. 1 is equal to sum over n, Brian cat n, right? So this just follows immediately from the fact that I can expand any wave function as a series in terms of any complete set of states, right? So this operator is just unity, and so let me insert that. Okay, so n here is any complete set of states, and in our case, a convenient choice for a complete set of states are the eigenstates of sigma z. Okay, so I will choose as my complete set of states here. Oops. So our more complete set of states is going to be eigenstates of the sigma iz operator at every site. So this just means that we specify whether the spin is up or down, right, at every site. So then I can write identity resolution in the following way, a sum over all the possible distributions of the eigenvalues of sigma z on all the sides of the lattice, right? And I'll write this in Dirac notation like this. So sigma z, sigma z, and what this means is just a product. So this is simply equal to the product over all sides in the lattice from 1 to n of sigma z eigenstates on a given lattice site. Okay. So this is this set of states is the same as summing over all of these eigenstates is the same as summing over all configurations of spins in the classicalizing model. Right? This is the same thing. Okay. So let's now insert this set of states. Okay. So I have M, capital M such factors. So therefore I need M minus one identity resolutions, right? So we insert capital M minus one identity resolutions. Okay, so I'll get and okay, so let me just to keep track of those identity resolutions, let me label them. So I will introduce an index. So integer index small n, okay, which is going to go from 0 to m, okay, and you will understand why it's from 0 to m instead of from 1 to m minus 1. In a second. So this index is going to label all the different identity resolutions. Okay. And so I can also introduce a corresponding real variable I will call tau sub n, which is simply going to be epsilon times n, right? And so this variable has dimensions of time. So tau n is time. So it has dimensions of time. Okay, so then you see that in particular that tau zero, right, is equal to zero, while tau m is equal to beta, right? So it's a time going from zero to inverse temperature. Okay. Okay, so let's do this now. So I have z, right. And so this is equal to sum, so let's say sigma z, and right, another thing is that, so why do I have this index running from 0 to m? So this is because the trace itself here, right, means precisely sum over again, over all of those eigenstates, right? So z is in fact sum over all the distribution of the eigenvalues of sigma z, right? Sigma z e to minus beta h. Sigma z, right? This is what trace is, and so this is why. So this is going to be my set of states that's labeled by tau 0, by n equals 0, and this is going to be the set of states labeled by tau m, right? And I will have periodic boundary conditions because this set of states is the same as this set of states, right? So in fact, the sigma z's at tau 0 are going to be equal to sigma z's at tau m. Okay? Okay, so let me write it down and then it will become clear, I think. Okay, so I have now sigma z of tau 1, let's say, sum over sigma z of tau m. Okay? I don't have to sum over sigma z of tau 0 because they are the same as sigma z of tau m. Okay. So actually I'm going to have sigma z of tau m on the left, okay? Then my first factor, so e to minus epsilon h1 e to minus epsilon h0, okay? Then here I have my first inserted identity resolution, right? So this is going to be sigma z of tau capital M minus 1, right? And again, sigma z of tau capital M minus 1. So this is my first inserted identity resolution, right? Then again, this factor, e to minus epsilon h1, e to minus epsilon h0, then I will have sigma z of tau m minus 2, right? And so on. Okay, so that is sigma z of tau m minus 2, okay, and so on, until we get to the last one. So I'll get here sigma z of tau 1, right? And my last pair of factors, e to minus epsilon h1, e to minus epsilon h0, and then so sigma z of tau 0, right? But in fact, so sigma z of tau 0 has to be the same as sigma z of tau m, because this is, it's those two pair of eigenstates, which is just external, right, when I calculate the trace. Okay? Is this clear? Okay, so explicitly, yes, I'll have that sigma z of tau m has to be equal to sigma z of tau 0, which means that I have periodic boundary conditions with respect to this time variable. Okay, so periodic boundary condition in time. Okay. Okay. So now let's evaluate actually those things here. So let me write this in a kind of shorthand form. So z is going to be sum sigma z of tau m up to, or down to sigma z of tau 1. And then this product I will just write as product over n from 0 to m minus 1, right? Sigma z of tau n plus 1 e to minus epsilon h1 e to minus epsilon h0 sigma z of tau n, right? And that's it. Okay. So this reproduces this this product here, right? Okay. So let's now evaluate this this matrix element. Okay. So I have sigma z of tau n plus 1 e to minus epsilon h1 e to minus epsilon h0 sigma z of tau n. Okay, so explicitly this is sigma z of tau n plus 1. And then I have e to epsilon h sum over I sigma I x, right? And then e to epsilon j sum over I and j sigma z I sigma z j. And so this is acting on the states sigma z of tau m, right? So okay, so these states are eigenstates of sigma z. So therefore, here for this term, all I have to do is just replace these operators by their eigenvalues, right? So this is equal to. Okay, so let's write here. So this is equal to sigma z of tau n plus 1 e to epsilon h sum over I sigma I x. And so here I just replace those by eigenvalues at this moment of time tau n, right? So e to epsilon j sum over I and j sigma z I of tau n sigma z j of tau n. So now those are not operators anymore. These are just the eigenvalues of sigma z corresponding to this particular set of states, right? And then multiplying again sigma z of tau n. Okay, so the non-trivial thing here is to evaluate this the matrix elements of this operator, right? Because this is these are not eigenstates of sigma x, so therefore this matrix element is going to be non-trivial. Okay, so let's evaluate that one. Okay, so I have sigma z of tau n plus 1 e to epsilon h sum over I sigma I x. Okay, so let me just focus on that matrix element. Sigma z of tau n. Okay. Now, okay, so this operator e to epsilon h sum over I sigma I x, right? This is the same as product over I, so from 1 to capital N, e to epsilon h times sigma I x, right? And every such product I can rewrite in the following way. So, okay, so e to epsilon h sigma I x Okay. I can write this as so hyperbolic cosine of epsilon h times sigma I zero, and sigma zero is just a unit matrix. Okay, so 2 by 2 unit matrix. Sigma zero is just 1, 0, 0, 1. Okay. Plus sine hyperbolic of epsilon h sigma I x. So this, you know, this is an analog. So you may have seen kind of the what's called the real time version of that. So if I had e to I, so e to I sigma x times this, this is expanded in terms of cosine and sine, right? And it follows immediately from the fact that the square of any of the Pauli matrices is a unit matrix, right? So this follows from the fact that sigma ix squared is just a unit matrix, okay? So basically the way you show this is by I guess is by Taylor expanding this exponential, right? And then, so once you start Taylor expanding, all the terms are going to be proportional to either sigma x, right, or sigma zero, because sigma x squared is only sigma zero. Okay. Okay. So now let me just take my other notes. Okay, so then I can write this matrix element here. Let me call it capital X. Okay, so capital X is equal to, so sigma z of tau n plus 1. And so then I have a product over all sides of the lattice from 1 to n of this thing. So hyperbolic cosine of epsilon h sigma I 0 plus hyperbolic sine of epsilon h sigma I x, right? And so this is acting on sigma z of tau m, right? Now, so let's look at this at this matrix here. So this 2 by 2 matrix cosine of epsilon h sigma sigma zero plus sine epsilon h sigma x, right? So this is in matrix notation. It's going to be a 2 by 2 matrix with cosine epsilon h on the diagonal, and then sine hyperbolic of epsilon h away from the diagonal. Okay. So my claim is that this matrix can be rewritten in the following way: as E to write it like this, as some A, and so we will find what this A is, times e to another constant k2 sigma z let's say 1 sigma z 2, okay, where 1 and 2 here just refers to so it just refers to tau n plus 1 and tau n. So let me just find those constants, and then you will understand what this means. So what does this mean? So to make this indeed equal to this, what I have to do is set, first of all, so when both sigmas are the same, right, so that refers to the diagonal elements on this matrix, right, then I have A, so this is equal to A times e to the k2, right, so therefore A times e to the k2 has to be equal to hyperbolic cosine of epsilon h, right, while when they're not the same, right, they have to be equal to the sine, so e to minus A times e to minus k2 has to be equal to hyperbolic sine of epsilon h. So these are two equations for two unknowns, right, A and k2. And so if I solve them, let me just skip the algebra here. So I can find A, for example, by taking the product, right? So then obviously A is just equal to square root of 1 half hyperbolic sine of 2 epsilon h, right? And then k2 is going to be 1 half log of cotangent hyperbolic, so it's a ratio of hyperbolic cosine and sine of epsilon h. Okay. So what it means then is that this matrix element X is just equal to product of these kind of exponentials, right, over all the lattice sites, right? Because this, as you remember, this set of this eigenstate here is just can be just written as a product of eigenstates of sigma z on any given site, right? So x then is just the product over I from 1 to n, right, of A times E to K2, right? And so again, so this sigma z1 here refers to sigma z's, the eigenvalues of sigma z taken at time n plus 1, right? While this sigma z2 refers to eigenvalues of sigma z taken at time tau n. So I get sigma zi of tau n plus 1, sigma zi of tau n, right? So this is the same as a to the n, and then e to k2 sum over I, sigma zi tau n plus 1 sigma zi of tau n, okay? And so you see that the matrix element, so So what this means is that the matrix element of this transverse field term, right, looks like actually like interaction between sigma z's, right, at the same site, but at neighboring time moments, right? And so then my partition function takes the following form. I can write z now as sum over sigma z's at tau m sigma z of tau 1, right? And then I have a product over n from 0 to m minus 1, right? And my matrix element now has the following form. So e to k2 sum over I sigma zi of tau n plus 1 sigma zi of tau n, right? And then e to k1, where k1 is just equal to epsilon j, right? Sum over I and j sigma zi of tau n sigma zj of tau n. Right? And so k2 here is equal to epsilon times j. And I have neglected, in our usual way, this prefactor of a to the n here, because this is just a constant multiplying the partition function. Is not going to affect anything. Okay, so this then looks like, okay, so let me just rewrite it one more time. So it's sigma z of tau m sum over sigma z of tau 1. Okay. And so let me now write this this product of exponentials as exponential of the sum. So I get e to k2, right? Now sum over n from 0 to m minus 1 and sum over I sigma z I of tau n plus 1 sigma z I of tau n, right? And then e to k2, again, sum over n from 0 to m minus 1, sum over I and j, so sigma zi of tau n, sigma zj of tau n. Okay? Yeah?
Should it be k1 equal to tau n j?
Yeah, k1. This is k1, I guess. Thank you. Okay, so what does this look like? So now this looks like the partition function of a classical Ising model, right? All we are doing is now just summing over over different values of sigma z, right? But it's a classical Ising model in a dimension, in a one higher dimension, right? And the extra dimension is this time here. Okay, so this looks like z partition function of a classical of a classicalizing model, but in z plus 1 dimensions, where the extra dimension is this time variable. Okay, so this. So let me kind of make a drawing of that. So suppose my, just for the presentation purposes, my Isaac model was defined on a one-dimensional lattice, right? And so now my space-time system has two dimensions. And so I have, let's say, I have a square lattice now. Okay, so let's say this is the space dimension, and this is time, right? And so the system at finite temperature, we have a finite extent, finite size in this time dimension, and the size is equal to beta, right? So taking the limit of t going to zero corresponds to just taking thermodynamic limit in the time direction, right? So when I take t to zero, beta is going to infinity, and so this lattice becomes, the system becomes infinite in the time dimension, right? And so I have spins now defined on the sides of this lattice, right? And I have an interaction of strength k1 when the spins are separated along the space dimension, right? And it's an interaction of strength k2, right? When they are separated along time, along the temporal dimension, right? So the only slight difference from what we had before is that k1 and k2 are not equal, right? But that's not a problem. This can be eliminated just by rescaling, let's say, spatial or temporal coordinates. So we will do this just a little bit later. So let's now look more closely at these constants, k1 and k2, right? So let's see first how they behave. Yeah.
So the dynamics of the system is like a random walk?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Now, we will talk about this just a little later, okay? So let's look at K1 and K2. So I have K1 equals epsilon j, right? So K1 is actually going to zero as epsilon is going to zero, right? While K2 is so it's 1/2 log of hyperbolic cotangent of epsilon h. Now, okay, so what is hyperbolic cotangent? Hyperbolic cotangent of epsilon h is hyperbolic cosine of epsilon h divided by hyperbolic sine of epsilon h. As I take epsilon to zero, the cosine is going to 1, while sine is going to epsilon h. So this is approximately 1 over epsilon h, where epsilon is small. So this behaves as 1/2 log of 1 over epsilon h. Okay, so this one actually goes to infinity as I take epsilon to zero. Okay. Infinity as epsilon is going to zero. So in principle, this system, this classical Ising model, becomes very strongly anisotropic as I take the limit of epsilon goes to zero. But that doesn't matter. Okay, anisotropy doesn't affect anything, as we've already seen. Right. So the geometry of the lattice doesn't really affect the critical properties. Okay, so let me now do the following. So to make kind of the analogy to the classical Ising model complete, right, I want to kind of see what is the analog of temperature for this classical Ising model, right? So the real temperature is just the size of the system, right, in the temporal dimension. So if I take it to zero, this goes to infinity. But so what is the analog of temperature in this d plus one dimensional Ising model? Okay. Okay. So let's let me rewrite those constants in the following way. Okay. So first of all, so let me so epsilon h. So let me solve. Let me take this equation for k2, right, and solve for epsilon in terms of k2. Okay, so I will get epsilon h, right, is equal to so e minus 2k2, right. So this is just solving this equation for epsilon. And if I plug this in here, then I get k1 equals j over h e minus 2k2, right? Or so k1 times e to 2k2 equals j over h, okay? Okay, so now let me do the following. So let me write my k1 as j1 divided by some temperature T tilde, so that T tilde is going to be the analog of temperature in that model, right? Because the so these coupling constants have to be they are dimensionless. They have to be if you want to make an analogy to classical Ising model, they have to be equal to the ratio of the you know, something that has dimensions of energy that describes the interaction between the spins divided by the temperature, right? So J1 over T tilde K2 is equal to J2 over T tilde, okay? Okay, and so then let me plug this in here. So I get J1 divided by T tilde times E to 2J2 divided by T tilde. And this has to be equal to J divided by H, okay? Okay, so what does this mean? So if I increase, so if I look at the left-hand side, let's say J1 and J2 are fixed, right? And so if I increase T tilde, the left-hand side of this equation decreases. And then on the right-hand side, to make it decrease, I have to increase H, increase the transverse field relative to J, okay? So what it means is that the increasing temperature in this classical D plus one dimensional Ising model is equivalent to increasing H in my quantum d-dimensional Ising model, right? So increasing H basically, so if I start from the ground state at large J, which is all spins just ordered in a particular direction, so all sigma z's are roughly equal to either 1 or minus 1, then increasing h means increasing the strength of quantum fluctuations, right? And so in the in my classical d plus 1 dimensional model, that's equivalent to just increasing temperature, okay? Which again, increases fluctuations of sigma z's, okay? Okay, so this means that basically H, the transverse field in the quantum model, is equivalent to T tilde, which is the effective temperature in the classical D plus one dimensional Ising model. Okay. So this is clear. Okay, so let me actually skip this thing because we don't have time. Okay, so now given this, I can repeat all the same steps that we have done before for the classical Ising model, right? So let me go here. So let me now define a Hamiltonian. I will call it, let's say, H tilde of this classical D plus one dimensional model, right? So this is just equal to minus J1 sum over n from 0 to m minus 1 sum over I and J. Sigma z I of tau n plus 1 tau n sigma z j of tau n, right? And I can even lose the z's at this point, so sigma i's are just ones and minus ones, right? And then minus j2 sum over n from 0 to m minus 1, and sum over I, sigma I of tau n plus 1, sigma I of tau n, right? Okay, so what I can do is again take this and do the Hubbard-Sartorovich transformation, right? So I will get S of phi, right, equals sum on I and J, right, phi I, J I J inverse, where J I J inverse is the inverse of this matrix of interactions, right? Same thing, phi J, and then minus sum over I log of twice hyperbolic cosine of phi I now divided by T tilde, right? And by exactly the same arguments as before, I can go from this to its continuum Landau-Ginzburg version, right? So I'll get S of phi, right? And so now I will have an integral from 0 to beta over the time variable tau, right? And an integral over the space variable, so d dx, So I'll have a term which is proportional to gradient of phi squared in the time direction. So this is just the time derivative, d tau phi squared, right? Plus 1/2 grad phi squared, and the gradient refers to all the spatial directions, right? And I can always make the coefficients equal just by rescaling my time and space coordinates. And then plus was the same thing, r over 2 phi squared plus u over 4 factorial phi to the fourth. Okay? And again, if I take the temperature to zero, that just means that I'm taking thermodynamic limit with respect to this time variable. So the time extent, the extent of the system in the time dimension also becomes infinite. Okay? So this in this context is called imaginary time. Imaginary time action. Okay, so my partition function of the transverse field of the quantum Ising model is integral, functional integral over phi e to minus this action s of phi. Okay, so why is this called imaginary time? So this is what I skipped maybe, but let me just briefly talk about this. So, you know, this refers to kind of analogy with the path integral representation of quantum mechanics, right? So you know that if I, that I can, in quantum mechanics, I can calculate, I can write down a path integral representation of the evolution operator, right? So let's say if I have a Schrödinger equation, so I d dt psi equals h psi, and I'm still keeping h bar equal to 1, right? Then so I can formally solve this Schrödinger equation in terms of the evolution operator. So psi of some t final is just equal to e to minus I t, e to minus I t final minus t initial times the Hamiltonian times psi of t initial. So this operator is called the evolution operator, right? Because it evolves the wave function in time. Okay. And so the point is that this evolution operator can be you can write this in a path integral representation, and so it's going to be exactly the same thing. Basically, what you will have here is a sum over all possible paths in real space that the particle can take between time, initial time, and the final time. Okay, and so the exponential is going to be e to I s of phi, where s of phi is going to be the real time action of the particle. Right. So let's erase this. So basically the point is that I can write a matrix element of the evolution operator, so matrix element between some x point x final, so e to minus I, so let's say, let me call this t final minus t initial, let me call this t, okay? So e to minus h t x initial, right? So this is actually equal to integral over all possible paths from x initial to x final, such that x of time equals 0 is equal to x initial, right? X of t is equal to x final dx, and then e to I s of x, right? Where s of x is just the action of the particle. So s of x is equal to, so integral from 0 to t dt, right, of the Lagrangian, so m x dot squared over 2 minus v of x, where v of x is whatever the potential the particle is moving in. Okay? So the point is that now, so if I make a transformation, t going to I tau, okay, so I substitute an imaginary time for this real time, and this transformation is called Weak's rotation. So if I send t actually to minus I tau, right, then what do I get? I get now integral from 0 to tau, right, d tau, and then there is a factor of minus I, right? So this thing is going to give me minus 1, so I'll get minus m x minus m over 2 d 2 x d tau squared minus v of x, right? And then, so this thing is just going to become integral dx, right, e to minus s of x, where s of x is the imaginary time action, okay? So s of x is equal to integral from 0 to, let me call this, tau prime, and this is t prime, sorry about this. So integral from 0 to tau d tau prime, right, m over 2 d 2x d tau prime squared plus v of x, which is nothing but the energy, right, of the particle. So basically, and we see that this expression looks exactly the same as this one, okay? So basically, you can think of this of quantum statistical mechanics as dynamics in imaginary time, okay? So, you know, if I were to do quantum statistical mechanics for just one particle, this is precisely what I get for its what I would get for its partition function. Yeah.
Sorry, is that dx d tau squared as opposed to d squared x?
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you. Dx d tau prime squared. Right. So, you know, if you're not familiar with this, then it's actually a good idea to go over this in your tutorial, okay? Okay. But so going back to our problem, right? So again, we can just repeat everything that that we have done before, right? So we can set up 4 minus epsilon expansion. In this case, it's going to be 3 minus epsilon if 3 is our space dimension. So we can set up 3 minus epsilon expansion. Right. Uh, And so all the results, all the previous results basically carry over to this case. So the only thing that you have to change is increase the dimensionality by one. Okay? So basically there is an exact mapping. What we have done is an exact mapping of quantum phase transition in a d-dimensional transverse field Ising model, right, to a classical phase transition in a d-dimensional classical Ising model, to classical in a d plus one dimensional classical Ising model. And so now also, you know, the analogy with quantum field theory here is really kind of glaring, right? So this is nothing but the imaginary time action for a scalar bosonic field, right? This is just your Klein-Gordon theory. Yeah.
So, going back to quantum field theory, there I can always do a systematic expansion in orders of h bar. So if I didn't set h bar to one here, would that expansion follow the derivative expansion?
Right. So I guess expansion in powers of h bar, so the quasi-classical expansion. So that in this language that corresponds to mean field theory, right?
Well, no, so zero order is mean field theory.
So you're right. So the saddle point of this action is precisely the Klein-Gordon theory, right? But yeah. So the expansion in powers of H would be the expansion, I guess, of in fluctuations around the saddle point here. There is no parameter here that would control this expansion, and in fact, the expansion will break down, right? At the critical point, but yeah. Okay. Okay. So what I want to do now in the remaining time. Just one thing before I move on. Is this one question you can ask? So is this kind of a general property that any quantum phase transition can be mapped onto a classical phase transition in one higher dimensions? So the answer is no. This is not a general property. So this works for the Ising model, for the transverse field Ising model, but it does not work in general. And the problem is that when you try, what you often find when trying to do this mapping is that your imaginary time action in the end turns out to be not real. Okay, so here, right, necessary condition for interpreting this action as just a Ginzburg-Landau functional of some classical model is that this has to be real, right? Because e to minus s of phi is just a Boltzmann weight. So it has to be real. But in many cases, your imaginary time action turns out to be complex. So there are terms here called periphases. So periphases can make S of phi complex, right? And so this, in general, prevents this identification of a or this analogy between a quantum phase transition in D dimension and classical phase transition in D plus one dimension. Okay, so in fact, you know, most of the really interesting quantum phase transitions have those Berry phases, and then you know, there is no analogy to any classical phase transition in this case. Okay, so we will not consider such cases. Let's just keep this in mind, okay? So that this analogy doesn't always work. Okay, so what I want to do now, finally, in the remaining time, is to extend this analogy to correlations, right? So in the classical Ising model, we have correlation functions, right, which describe how the fluctuations of the spins are correlated in space, right? So here, we have both space and time, right? And so the presence of time direction basically, so the correlation and the time direction gives you an idea of how fluctuations propagate in time, okay? So, and so the non-trivial thing here is to figure out how correlations in imaginary time translate into correlations in real time. Okay, so this is not completely trivial, and so let me talk about this now. Okay, so let me define an imaginary time correlation function. In the following way, so it's going to be Gij, so I and j refer to the spatial sites on the lattice of tau, okay, and this is going to be, so t tau, I will explain what that is in a second, and then the expectation value of sigma z I of tau, sigma z j of zero, so this t tau here is what's called the time ordering operator, so its purpose is just to put later operators corresponding to later times to the left. Okay, so in this case, if tau is positive, so this is equal to sigma zi of tau sigma zj of zero when tau is greater than zero, right? And it's the opposite, sigma zj of zero sigma zi of tau when tau is less than zero. Okay? Yeah.
These are the Matsubara green functions.
Well, yeah. So those will be when we Fourier transform this, those will be Matsubara Green's functions. Yes. Okay. So I just want to, so formally the reason I want to do this is because then there is a simple functional integral representation of this function. But, you know, so you can think of this as kind of expressing causality, right? So I always want to be the cause to the right and then the effect to the left, right? And now, so what is sigma z of tau? So sigma z of tau is just the imaginary time Heisenberg operators, Heisenberg representation for the operators. So by definition, this is equal to e to h tau sigma zi, where sigma zi is just a Pauli matrix, right? time independent, e to minus h tau. So this is the just the imaginary time. Time Heisenberg representation of the operator sigma z. Okay. Right. Okay. Now, so remember that we always have periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time, right? So, which means that phi or sigma z of tau equals zero is always equal to sigma z of tau equals beta, right? That just follows from the fact that we have this trace, right? So we have periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time, which means that all correlation functions also have to be periodic in imaginary time, right? So this means that Gij of tau plus beta, right, must be always equal to Gij of tau. Okay, so it's a this correlation function is a periodic function in imaginary time. So this implies that if I want to Fourier transform that with respect to the time, the imaginary time variable, it's going to be a sum over what's called Matsubara frequencies. So Gij of tau is given by 1 over beta sum over omega sub n Gij of omega n e to minus I omega n tau, right? And so what are the values of omega n, right? So if I want this periodic boundary condition to be always satisfied, I must have e to minus I omega n times beta. This always has to be equal to 1, right? So this means that omega n has to be equal to 2 pi n divided by beta, where n is any integer. 0, plus minus 1, plus minus 2, and so on. So these are also called bosonic Matsubara frequencies. So the point is that if you try to do the same thing for a system of fermions, then it turns out that because you know fermion operators, creation and annihilation operators, anti-commute, then for fermions, it's not a periodic boundary condition in imaginary time, it's anti-periodic. And so then the fermionic Matsubara frequencies contain, it's going to be pi to n plus 1 instead of 2 pi n. Okay, but it doesn't matter, okay? Let's calculate this this correlation function formally, assuming kind of we know exactly the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. Okay, so let me just for concreteness assume that tau is greater than zero, okay? So then I have Gij of tau, this is equal to sigma z I of tau sigma z j of 0. So this is the expectation value of e to h tau sigma z I e to minus h tau sigma z j, right? And now, so this average, what is this equal to? This is just 1 over the partition function, right? Trace of e minus beta h times this thing. So e to h tau sigma z I e to minus h tau sigma z j, right? By definition. So suppose I know, suppose I can diagonalize this Hamiltonian. Okay, so suppose I know all the eigenstates and eigenvalues. So suppose I have h n equals e sub n m. So n here is the complete set of states of this Hamiltonian, complete set of eigenstates. So n set of eigenstates of h. So then I can write this trace explicitly in terms of the eigenstates of h in the following way. So let me do the same thing I did before and insert resolutions of identity in terms of all the factors here in this trace in terms of the complete set of state. Okay, of states, right? So I will insert 1 equals sum over n in between all the factors here. So then what do I get? I get this is equal to 1 over z sum over n and m. Okay, so there will be only two distinct sets of states, because the Hamiltonian itself, of course, is diagonal in its with respect to its eigenstate basis, right? So I have n e to minus beta h n, right, times n e to h tau still n, because h is diagonal, right? Then I get n sigma z I m. So sigma z is generally not diagonal. Then m e to minus h tau, again m here, and then m sigma z j n, right? And those two outer ends just come from the trace. Okay, and then so this kind of matrix element of e to h tau is just equal to e to e sub n tau. I just replace h by the eigenvalue. So this is equal to, so let me write it down and then I'll finish. So this is equal to 1 over z, so sum over n and m. So I get e to minus beta e sub n, e to minus to plus tau e sub n, then, so n sigma z I m, then I get e to minus e sub m times tau, and then m sigma z j n, right? So, okay, so what I have on the end is 1 over z, sum over n and m, e to minus beta e sub n, e to minus em minus en tau, and then n sigma z I m, m sigma z j m. Okay, so we will finish this next time.